I love the idea of like a potato hopper that just like grinds them up like with coffee beans, and Pringles are getting shot out into cans on the other end. Hello and welcome to Terrifying Robot Dog. I'm Jonathan Stark.
And I'm Kelly Shaver.
And we're here to talk about how technology is changing the way we interact with the world. This week, in part two of our mini-series on 3D printing, we are going to talk specifically about FDM printing, or Fused Deposition Modeling, which is a consumer-grade version of 3D printing. Please stay tuned. Terrifying Robot Dog is next. Okay.
We are back.
Yes, we are back, and better than ever, frankly. I am kind of excited about this episode. It is it's the thing I think of when I think of 3D printing.
Yeah. And we had a little bit of an overview teaser kind of thing last time, and now we're just going to kind of get into the meat of 3D printing with FDM printers. So that should be fun.
Yes. So let's just quickly say how this works. So how does it's impossible for me to say this. Fused deposition modeling. It sounds like a legal problem, like a legal exercise.
Our depositions are fused.
Right, something you do to prepare for a legal proceeding.
Yeah, I don't think it's that type of deposition. I think it just means depositing things that fuse together.
I think so. I just can't say it.
Yeah.
So we'll stick with FDM.
How does FDM printing work? Mm-hmm. Well, first off, actually, a lot of the 3D printing that we talked about last week starts off kind of the same way, where you will have this CAD software on a computer, specialized CAD software called a slicer, basically. And what it does is it will take your model and it slices it into like really thin layers. Hmm. And that layer height varies anywhere between like 0.1 millimeter to, I don't know, maybe 0.5, depending on your printer resolution and what you've set it to.
Oh, I love the concept of resolution in physical space.
On a 3D printer,
that's
crazy. Yeah, and it makes a difference too.
Sure.
Yeah. Because a lot of times with 3D printed objects, you can tell, like there'll be little ridges on it.
Yep.
And that's the printer's resolution,
which is excellent if you're making potato chips, but might not be perfect.
Yeah, if you're 3D printing potato chips.
I feel like that's what Pringles basically are. They're like 3D printed potato chips.
Yeah, because they don't taste like real potato chips.
No, but they are delicious.
Oh, yeah, they're good. They just don't taste like real potato. Like maybe they were just extruded from a potato.
That's possible.
Yeah.
I love the idea of like a potato hopper that just like grinds them up like with coffee beans, and Pringles are getting shot out into cans on the other end. Or perhaps directly into my mouth, which would be preferable.
So
resolution in physical space, we've got the slicer model. This makes sense.
And you can also set things like the density that you want it to print at. So, you know, maybe you're trying to save on material because you're doing something that's, maybe it's just a display piece or it's not going to have any functional use. You can say, okay, we're going to print this, but let's make it a little less dense.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
So yeah, then your slicer basically sends that information to your 3D printer a layer at a time, and the printer, you know, it'll have this print bed that's sometimes heated, sometimes not. Heated is a little bit better. Mm-hmm. And it will heat the, you know, it's typically a spool of filament that gets fed into the print head, and it's heated to typically around 200 to 220 degrees Celsius. So it gets pretty hot. And then that is extruded through the print head onto this bed, and the head is on this sort of XYZ axis type, multi-axis type motor system.
Right.
And that will move it layer by layer, laying down printed material. And sometimes the bed moves and the print head is stationary. Sometimes the print head moves and the bed is stationary.
Oh, interesting. Huh. So how much time have you spent with one of these things, if any?
In person?
Yeah, or,
sadly, none.
Okay, yeah. I've been near them, and at this maker lab that I mentioned last week, they're pretty slow, at least the ones that I've seen.
They take a long time.
Borderline painfully slow, But I suppose it's one of those things that, you know, you can, it's kind of like the old days of printing when printing was really slow. You'd just be like, okay, I'm going to send this giant print job to the printer. Like when I worked at Staples and we'd print out an entire 400 page catalog that we were designing and be like, okay, let's go to lunch and then maybe out for a walk. And, you know.
Yeah, this is something that's like, okay, you start printing before you go to bed at night.
Okay. Yep. And you wake up to the morning. You wake up in the morning and find a ridgy little Yoda shaped iPhone case.
Or whatever. Right. Yeah. I mean it varies obviously based on the size and the fill density and all of that. Sure. As far as how long it's gonna take. Mm-hmm. 24-hour prints are not an uncommon thing for a decently large sized item.
Yep. Which might
which is why heated beds are typically better, because they prevent the model from warping.
Interesting.
As it cools.
Oh, gotcha. It's kind of like when I wash my cutting boards and I don't stand them up to dry and they become convex.
Yeah.
It's actually just like that. I don't know what made me think of that.
Are they plastic cutting boards?
They are. No, wooden. Wooden, yeah. Oh. So they dry funny. So like a 24-hour print time might sound painfully slow, but if you need to prototype something, you know, you could be 3 days of prototype something or create a part for something. It could easily be 3 days of shipping plus postage. And if you're trying to prototype something and you need to send it out to a shop or something, I could imagine that it would be cost prohibitive or time prohibitive. And for people, I mean, from people I've spoken to about it, it seems like the big advantage is that it actually gets them a prototype quickly, even though it sounds like it takes a long time in the scheme of things compared to, say, printing, a PDF.
Yeah, yeah. And 3D printing seems like it would be expensive, and on one hand, it kind of is. But again, it's probably not nearly as expensive as sending your model off to some shop and having them print and pay them for materials and time and labor and shipping and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, get it back and realize it needs to be tweaked or it's a little too big and do it again. And, you know, how do you, it's kind of like, it reminds me of software debugging. If you don't have very quick feedback on your changes, then it's really, you know, it's painful to go around that cycle of, you know, build, debug, rebuild sort of thing.
Yeah, waiting for feedback is painful at times.
Yeah. So I'm imagining that people can share plans back and forth. Is there a common format that everybody's kind of settled on?
Yeah, it uses STL files. And what that is basically going back to the overview of 3D printing we did last week, talking about the SLA printers. STL is the stereolithography printer format. So the printers that have come later after that have sort of adopted this format for their slicer. Mm,
cool. All right. And does it take a particularly beefy computer to do this? I wouldn't think so.
Typically what you do is you'll have your slicer program that analyzes and all of this and outputs the data that's going to go into your 3D printer. And you'll put that on an SD card and then you'll shove the SD card in the printer.
Oh.
So you don't have... You may have a connection between the computer and printer for some initial setup and that sort of thing, but typically the printers will have their own SD card reader that takes this data from the slicer.
Oh, that's cool.
So, yeah. So, like, you don't have to tie up your computer for 24 hours.
So, okay, what different types of filament are there? Like, I've seen, like, a black kind that looks sort of like a weed whacker spool?
Well, they all pretty much all come on spools for the FDM printers. They kind of have to. But yeah, there's several different filament types. PLA plastic and ABS plastic are the two most common, and we're the first two. And of course, the ABS is going to be a little softer. The PLA is stronger but more brittle. There's some transparent filaments. There's some wood filaments, and think of it as coming out as kind of like pressed wood or MDF, where you have like this sort of bonding compound with all in your sawdust, basically.
Right, like everything from IKEA.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Think of it as you could 3D print your own Walmart furniture.
Oh man, that's a cool. Yeah, you could buy plans from IKEA for the spore chair.
You need a really big printer.
That is
to print a.
But, yeah. Yeah, just to type the whole name in, it would take a while.
Yeah, but you know when you buy it and it's like that one peg is missing.
Yes. That's never happened to me.
Yeah, no, never. But
that is a wild idea. Imagine if, I mean, okay, so let's just like diverge for 1 second and imagine that that instead of IKEA shipping, making stuff and shipping it to the US, they make the plans and email them or, you know, transmit them to the US where they are printed. God, that's wild.
Yeah.
That would change things, folks. I'm sure it's not economically feasible now for a million reasons, but
you wouldn't 3D print it. You wouldn't download a car.
Right. I mean, I feel like the future of the, like, it can't, I don't know, man. I mean, the concept is desktop manufacturing. So at some point there, it's, I don't know if it's rational or reasonable or will ever be economically feasible, but you can imagine a situation where instead of shipping atoms, you ship bits and then reassemble them.
I was just going to say, you click the Amazon one click button on your Amazon Prime and it starts printing out on your little, yellow orange Amazon branded 3D printer sitting on your desk.
Yeah. Like if you don't think they're working on that, you're crazy. They must be. If Amazon, if you're listening, you can hire me to work on that. I want that to happen. Anyway. Okay. So we were talking about the different types of filament and you said wood, and that's where that sort of sent me for a loop. What else do you have?
Yeah. There's also metallic filaments that have metal bits, like metal flakes. There's a bronze.
So is it like a substrate, if that's the right word, that's got all this sort of flex in it, like glitter of metal?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And what else do we have? What are the other, any other materials?
I believe there's a, I'm not entirely certain if it's a glass type or if it's just transparent, but I think it may actually be a sort of glass-based, again, substrate type filament.
Man, that'd be cool. Huh.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can, you know, there's rubberized, if you want something, print something that has some flex to it. Like you can make your own little squishy iPhone cases.
So I remember there used to be a company, there probably still is, called Shapeways, that it sounded like they basically bought a 3D printer. And they would have people send plans to them and then they would print them out and turn them around really cheaply and quickly. So they were kind of trying to defray the cost of having this giant 3D printer. And they've been around for years. So,
Yeah. They've been around for years. Shapeways is still a thing. And you can go there and buy different models and you select the model you want and what material you want it printed in. And then you pay them an overpriced amount of money that is still less than buying a 3D printer.
Right. Exactly.
and you get the object in presumably a few days.
Right. So, and what's cool about it, if I remember, I don't know if they still do this, but they had this little marketplace for plans. So people would have like jewelry and art type stuff. And you could, I think the plans were free, or I think they were shared for free, or they were Creative Commons or something, but you know, who knows, that you, even if you could buy, you know, buy the plan for $5, then you pick your material you wanted it made out of, depending on how you're going to use it. And, you know, you could have, I think they had some milling stuff because I seem to remember it being more that type of model where you get those like dinosaur puzzles where you build the dinosaur skeleton out of thin sheets of plywood.
Yeah. I don't think it's just 3D printing. I think they do some milling and CNC work as well. And there's another service that I used a while back to prototype a little thing that I was trying to make. We'll have to link to it in the show notes because I don't remember the name and I couldn't pronounce it anyway. But they also do CNC and laser etching and that sort of stuff. And it was very reasonably priced, I thought, on a variety of materials. So we can link to that. But yeah, there's also Thingiverse, which if you have a 3D printer, is just a community for sharing and discovering and finding 3D models that other people have made.
Very cool. All right, sweet. So we're going to get into some of that. I think we're going to get a little bit deeper into that next week. So let's get into now how much we've talked about price a few times. How much does this cost? How much is like for a printer and how much is a spool of rubber or whatever?
Yeah. 3D printers range in price anywhere from $350 for a kit that you build yourself, which sounds really fun, but it's kind of intimidating, to upwards of $4,000 for a high-end MakerBot. From the research I've done on it and reviews I've watched of other people, I end up watching a lot of 3D printing videos and stuff because I just find it really interesting. Looks like printers in the $1,000 to $2,000 range is where you're going to get the best bang for your buck in terms of quality and consistency and reliability versus price. But if you're a tinkerer and don't mind doing a lot of tinkering and that sort of thing, you can certainly build yourself one or purchase an entry level one for significantly less than that. Mm,
cool.
You can get a low end already built one for around $650. Get the kit for $350, build it yourself, that sort of thing.
Wild. So just to put that in context, like let's say you were going to get one that was, I mean, even in the $1,000 to $2,000 price range, that on the one, you know, that's like, geez, that seems like a lot of money to drop on something like that. But I'm sure like my father-in-law's got 10 times that in his workshop, you know, for
right.
tools.
You look woodworking tools and all that.
It's, yeah. So if you were really, really in, you know, into this, the way that people are into woodworking, it's, mm-hmm. it's kind of the same thing, like in terms of, I mean, I see it as this very similar thing. Like his level of dedication is higher than the average person. I've got another right. friend who just randomly makes guitars in his basement just because he's into guitars and woodworking. So he's got tons of money sunk into that.
Right. I mean, I would consider the $1,000 to $2,000 a reasonable price range for an enthusiast type.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a perfect word.
Yeah.
And then you can imagine the 4K range. I can see that as not prohibitive at all for a small design firm, even a small design right. firm, clearly a large design firm. But if you are doing any kind of industrial design, that's like a no brainer.
Yeah. If you're using your 3D printer to make money, then that seems like a reasonable price.
Yeah. That's wild. And now how much is the material? So, you know, we're going through all these spools.
Typically a 1 kilogram spool, which is 2.2 pounds. is going to, of say, PLA plastic, for instance, is going to run you around $20.
Gotcha.
$17 to $20.
Gotcha. So basically, somebody who manufactures plastic is like, we figured out a way to charge $20 for 2 pounds of plastic.
Yeah. Look what we can do with our leftovers.
Exactly. That's cool. Hey, man. More power to them. It's basically ink, right?
Right. I mean, it sounds like a lot, but that'll print a significant amount of stuff.
Well, yeah, approximately 2 pounds.
I don't have offhand a conversion of how much. Yeah, but you think of just like 2.2 pounds of plastic. That's a lot of plastic.
Yeah, it is. It's a chunk.
Yeah.
So let's see. So I feel like it's still pretty early adopter stage. Maybe it's a smidge beyond early adopters or people who are using them for their businesses. So what sorts of things have you come across that are really common? Like what are the common things that once people first get them, like what's the first thing everybody prints, like a phone case or something?
You know, I really don't know. The first thing everybody prints.
I mean, the ones I've seen have been, it's like lots of phone cases. It's lots of jewelry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Art, just basically art. And ooh, there's one other thing, just like, well, I guess tchotchkes, I guess it depends on how good it is, whether you want to call it art or a tchotchke, but sort of decorative stuff, let's say, jewelry.
Yeah, I'd be printing D&D miniatures.
Nice. I am intrigued by the glass option.
Yeah.
The turnoff for me has been that I've had a couple of ideas where I really need to get the thing in physical space. You know, like, for example, I've got, you know, 30 or 40 old smartphones, and they're mm-hmm. difficult to store. I'd kind of like to have them out, not put away, because when I want to test something, I don't want to dig around looking for them.
Right.
And so I've come up with a couple of different storage options that I've prototyped just like with an X-Acto knife and cardboard mm-hmm. that I'm like, this is the shape I need, but this cardboard's not doing it for me.
Right.
It would be so cool to be able to just take that, convert it into a pattern, and then print it out with something that was not like gross. I wouldn't want it to be gross because it's going to end up on my desk and I would, you know.
Right. It's going to end up on display.
Yeah. So, you know, so metal or glass would be really, probably metal would be the coolest.
Yeah. Or even at the low end, just like solid black plastic.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but I'm much more intrigued. Probably the metal and glass are too expensive. You know, mm-hmm. end up with a $400, you know, plus the $600 for the thing. So for measly $1,000, I have a place to put my phones. But that's been the turnoff for me is that I'm like, well, plus I'm just not that type of person. Like I'm not a wood shop tool guy anyway. So I'm definitely not in the target market.
I'm becoming more and more that type of person.
It's like the Arduino mentality, you know, that like, let's make stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah, I'm very much becoming more and more a make stuff person.
Yep, that's great. So I can imagine, so the obvious things though are like to prototype ideas for mm-hmm. physical products that you are considering making, maybe for a Kickstarter or something you're going to, you know, try and sell, put in real production, making toys or like pieces for, you know, small repairs around the house.
Yeah, like that plastic tray on the bottom of the ice maker on the fridge broke again.
Kind of thing. Yeah. Well, so my father-in-law and my uncle are spending their retirement years, restoring classic cars. And this, yeah. I mean, if you could just create like a rubber nipple for a running board plug.
Oh, right. Yeah. Just the really hard to find and prohibitively expensive and just like little things that it would just be so much easier to print out one rather than hunt it down on the internet and pay a bunch of money for it.
Yeah. That would be wild. Like I had a conversation once with Erica's dad about going to, cause he'll go off on these sort of missions looking for a particular part and he goes to these junkyards and stuff. And I was like, I asked him if he thought that it would if it would be amenable to the junkyard proprietor, and if he thought there would be a business in it to just go there and scan the items and sort of, and make the plans available to people who would then mm-hmm. 3D print them. So he would sell plans mm-hmm. for like, a particular gasket from a Ford F-150 from 1935.
Right, like the knob for the window crank.
Yeah, totally. The stuff inside the cabin is often broken, and it's so visible. Man, that would be, I feel like that would be, that'd be a ton of work, but that would be such a cool business. And you could go around to the junkyards and be like, hey, I'll cut you in for 10% if you let me scan all your really rare right. pieces. Like, what are the 15 most expensive things you've got here to sell? I'll scan them.
Right, but then you start running into copyright issues, which might be a segue into next week's episode.
Next week, that is a perfect segue. So we can leave it here for this week and talk about that on next week's Terrifying Robot Dog. See you then.
Bye.
Would you like to support Terrifying Robot Dog? Just think of two friends who would dig the show and send them to terrifyingrobotdog.com for links to iTunes, Facebook, and RSS feeds. If you don't have two friends, you can still help us out by leaving a nice review in iTunes. Thanks a lot.